Good evening and welcome to this extended Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for August 4th, 2023. On today's program, we'll have Joe Ivester speaking to the Moscow League of Women Voters on the politics of raising a transgender child. Plus, Boise police kill fourth person this year. Brian Koberger's attorneys present alibi. Former Idaho Supreme Court justices say Koberger's challenge of grand jury indictments not likely to succeed, but if they do, it will likely make grand juries unworkable in the state without new legislation. Rosauer's supermarket employees at numerous stores, including in Moscow, eligible for $350,000 in unpaid back wages and damages, might causing most of the honeybee colony collapses in the Northwest, with pesticides second. Shootings killing most protected birds along Northwest power lines, not electrocution. And City of Lewiston report shows software problem led to the collapse of the High Street Reservoir in January. We'll have all those stories, but first, world headlines from FSN.
From Feature Story News in New York, I'm William Denslow. The Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has had his prison sentence extended by a further 19 years. He's told his supporters not to lose the will to resist. The trial took place in a penal colony where Navalny's been since 2021. He's been found guilty on charges of funding and founding an extremist organisation. He's already been serving a 9-year sentence on fraud and parole violation charges, allegations he denies, which are widely seen as politically motivated. A reenactment of a school shooting in the US state of Florida is taking place as part of an ongoing lawsuit. Live ammunition is being fired inside Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, where 17 people were killed in 2018. It's part of a lawsuit filed against a law enforcement officer who stayed outside during the massacre. Sally Patterson reports.
It was one of America's deadliest school shootings after a former student opened fire on Valentine's Day in 2018. Prosecutors claim school resource officer Scott Peterson ignored his training and intentionally avoided confronting the shooter. Peterson says he was unable to determine the source of the gunshots.
The military junta in Niger, which deposed the West African country's president last week, has scrapped a number of security and defence agreements with France. France currently has around 1,500 troops in Niger, but counter-terrorism operations have been suspended since the ousting of Mohamed Bazoum. Ross Cullen reports from Paris.
France pulled its forces out of Mali and Burkina Faso after military coups in both countries and moved the core of its operations in the southern Sahara to Niger. French soldiers are in the region to help dismantle armed groups, but the immediate future of the mission in Niger is now uncertain after the Nigerian army rulers revoked a raft of military cooperation agreements with France.
India's Supreme Court has suspended the conviction of the country's main opposition leader. Rahul Gandhi will be allowed to return to Parliament after his defamation conviction was suspended by the Supreme Court. Saroshi Mukherjee reports from the Indian capital.
Rahul Gandhi was disqualified as a member of parliament following his defamation conviction in March. He was sentenced to 2 years' imprisonment over comments he made in 2019, which were viewed as an insult to Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and other people sharing the same surname. The case against Mr. Gandhi was filed by Purnesh Modi, a lawmaker and a member of Narendra Modi's party, the BJP. Lower courts and the Gujarat High Court refused to suspend Mr. Gandhi's conviction, pushing him to appeal to the Supreme Court. Justice Gawai also said the ramifications of Rahul Gandhi's conviction would have affected the rights of electorates who have voted for him.
And the world's oceans have hit their highest temperatures on record, with scientists warning of major implications for the planet. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Federal District Judge B. Lynn Windmill in Boise has ruled death row inmate Gerald Pizzuto Jr. can proceed with a lawsuit against State Attorney General Raul Labrador and the Department of Correction for cruel and unusual punishment. Pizzuto has been on Idaho's death row for more than 35 years after a court convicted him of bludgeoning Berta Herndon and her nephew Delbert Herndon to death with a hammer in an Idaho County mountain cabin in July 1985. Since that time, judges have issued death warrants for Pizzuto's execution three times, in May of 2021, in November 2022, and in February of this year. The correction department canceled the 2022 death warrant because the agency could not obtain the execution chemicals. At that time, lethal injection was the only legal form of execution in Idaho. The legislature passed a bill this year allowing execution by firing squad if execution chemicals are not available. According to the Idaho Press, Windmill ruled Pizzuto's suit may move forward under a claim his Eighth Amendment rights may have been violated. Judge Windmill denied a second claim from Pizzuto that a 14th Amendment right was violated. Windmill wrote, as Pizzuto describes it, defendant's repeated rescheduling of his execution is like dry firing in a mock execution or a game of Russian roulette. With each new death warrant comes another spin of the revolver cylinder, restarting the 30-day countdown until the trigger pulls. Defendant's alleged practice of keeping Pizzuto in a state of perpetual terror by scheduling and rescheduling his execution, despite knowing that the lethal injection almost certainly will not be performed, plausibly constitutes cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment. The judge's decision means the claim is plausible, but is not yet proven. Moscow quadruple murder suspect Brian Koberger and his defense team provided an alibi for his whereabouts at the time of the November 13th murders on King Road in Moscow, saying he was out for a late-night drive and not at the King Road crime scene that night. Koberger was supposed to provide an alibi by July 24th, a deadline set through an agreement with Latah County Prosecutor Bill Thompson and Koberger's defense team. Koberger faces four counts of first-degree murder and one count of burglary for the November 13th stabbing murders of University of Idaho students Kaylee Gonsalves, Madison Mogan, Zaina Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin at their King Road home in Moscow. Judge John Judge arraigned Koberger in Second District Court in May, and Judge entered a not guilty plea on his behalf as Koberger stood silent through the proceedings. Jailers are holding Koberger in the Latah County Jail awaiting his trial, which Judge has scheduled for October 2nd through November 12th. Koberger faces the death penalty if convicted. Koberger's attorney, Ann Taylor, provided the court with the alibi information in her objection to Latah County Prosecutor Bill Thompson's earlier motion for the suspect and defense to provide an alibi defense for his whereabouts the night of the murders. Thompson said Koberger's attorneys did not specify where he was at the time of the murders and did not provide the names and addresses of witnesses who could support his alibi. In response, Taylor filed an objection saying the evidence may come out during cross-examination of state witnesses or during expert witness presentations. In Taylor's objection, she states Koberger was out driving alone late November 12th into November 13th. She wrote Koberger had a long habit of going on late-night drives. Taylor wrote in the objection, Mr. Koberger is not claiming to be at a specific location at a specific time. At this time, there is not a specific witness to say precisely where Mr. Koberger was at each moment of the hours between late night November 12th, 2022 and early morning November 13th, 2022. Taylor continued, saying Koberger cannot be more specific about possible witnesses for his alibi and what they will say. She said the defense has not had the opportunity to develop testimony through cross-examination and witness presentation because there was not a preliminary hearing and a secret grand jury indicted Koberger. Taylor asked the court in the objection to exempt Koberger from further inquiry into his alibi. She said her defense team is reviewing evidence as quickly as they can and continue to request more information, and claimed the prosecution is using the missed alibi deadline as a further opportunity to force Koberger to waive his right to a speedy trial. Taylor wrote, "The state continually uses those opportunities to attempt to force a waiver of speedy trial. That is a decision left to Mr. Koberger and Mr. Koberger alone." Judge has scheduled a hearing for Friday, August 18th, to discuss Koberger's alibi defense, the defense's motion to dismiss his indictment, and the possibility of a speedy trial. Two former Idaho Supreme Court justices say accused quadruple murderer Brian Koberger's defense claim that prosecutors gave the grand jury the wrong standard of proof to indict him is unlikely to succeed in getting the court to throw out the indictments, and if they do succeed, it would essentially end grand juries in Idaho without new legislation. Koberger is facing four counts of first-degree murder in the November 2022 stabbing deaths of four University of Idaho students, Kaylee Gonsalves, Madison Mogan, Zaina Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin. The defense filed a motion to throw out the grand jury indictment last week. One of Koberger's attorneys, Kootenai County Public Defender's Office Chief Deputy of Litigation Jay Logsdon, said prosecutors should have told the grand jury they needed proof beyond a reasonable doubt in order to indict. Grand juries in Idaho can indict based on probable cause. Logsdon said Idaho law says, quote, "The grand jury ought to find an indictment when all the evidence before them, taken together, if unexplained or uncontradicted, would, in their judgment, warrant a conviction by a trial jury." Retired Idaho Supreme Court Justice Joel Horton told the Idaho Statesman the law Logsdon quotes is ambiguous and notes the passage does not use the term reasonable doubt. Horton said the state constitution does not offer much guidance on the issue. He said it would be an uphill battle for the defense to win on the issue, and if they did win, it would essentially mean the end of grand juries in Idaho without new legislation. Former Idaho Supreme Court Chief Justice Jim Jones told the Idaho Statesman in an email, "It's unlikely the defense will win on the issue, and if they did, it would, quote, overturn long-standing Idaho law regarding the standard that must be met to support a grand jury indictment." Jones later said in a phone interview, "It's really hard to flub a grand jury. There's not much you can do to screw up the process. I don't think this has any chance of success." Former Idaho Attorney General David Leroy told the Statesman he agrees with defense attorney Logsdon's interpretation of state law. Leroy, who is now a criminal defense lawyer, said, "It's a quirky situation that has lain undetected in Idaho criminal procedure for more than a century." Logsdon argued in his motion, changing the standard of evidence for a grand jury indictment would overturn a, quote, tragic and unconstitutional, unquote, misinterpretation of the grand jury indictment standard in the state. Logsdon wrote, "The defense recognizes that the whole of modern jurisprudence on this issue is against it, as well as at least one founding father of this state. Mr. Koberger is asking the court to recognize the long string of error that has led us here and give back the people of this state the protections they are owed." Second District Judge John Judge will hear arguments on the defense's grand jury indictment motion and other motions Friday, August 18th. According to a newly released study from Boise State University, illegal shootings along power lines are now the leading cause of death of many protected bird species in Idaho and surrounding states, not electrocution. The journal Science at ScienceDirect.com recently published the study entitled "Illegal Shooting is Now the Leading Cause of Death of Birds Along Power Lines in the Western USA." The Idaho Capital Sun reports Boise State University raptor researcher and study lead author Eve Thomason said the cause of bird deaths sparked her interest while working for a utility company conducting risk assessment surveys along power lines. Thomason said she noticed many dead birds in areas around power lines normally considered safe. She said on closer inspection, she noticed someone had shot many of the birds. Thomason said, birds are drawn to power poles and power lines in our region. They're often the tallest feature across the landscape, so this provides birds with a vantage point across the landscape. It gives birds a place to perch, hunt, or nest, but this also presents some risk. Thomason said, since power lines are energized, birds making contact with two parts of a power line at the same time, usually during taking flight or landing on a power pole, are electrocuted. Thomason told the Idaho Capital Sun her graduate research was aimed at the assumption electrocution was the greatest threat to birds along power lines in the western U.S. Thomason teamed with private, state, and federal agencies to try to find the leading cause of death for birds found near power lines in the western U.S. From 2019 to 2022, Thomason and her team collected 410 dead birds along 120 miles of power lines in Idaho, Oregon, Utah, and Wyoming. The dead birds included protected species such as bald eagles, golden eagles, and several species of hawks. The researchers sent the dead birds to the Idaho Department of Fish and Game's Wildlife Forensic Lab for examination. When examiners x-rayed the dead birds, they found 175 of the 410 birds, or 66%, died from gunshots. Only one of the 175 birds which died from gunshots, a pigeon, was not a protected species. Examination showed besides the 66% of birds killed by gunshot, 17% died from electrocution, and another 17% died from collision. Thomason said although many of the dead birds showed visible signs of electrocution, such as burns and singed feathers, x-rays showed many of those carcasses also had gun pellets throughout their bodies. U.S. Geological Survey conservation biologist Todd Katzner, who is Thomason's graduate advisor, said, although utility companies like Idaho Power have taken steps to mitigate bird electrocution and collision, there are not many ways to mitigate illegal shooting of birds. Katzner said, the primary threat to larger birds that are perched on power lines is going to be illegal shooting. We collected an awful lot of dead birds, and a huge proportion of them had been shot illegally. As scientists and as humans, we tend to think of this type of behavior as occasional and rare, and what we're finding is that it's much more common than we previously experienced. Boise police shot and killed a man at an apartment complex near Boise State University yesterday afternoon. The man is the sixth person Boise police have shot this year and the fourth who died from a police shooting. According to the Idaho Press, Boise Police Chief Ron Winiger said two of his officers shot and killed the man because he had charged them with an edged weapon at around 11 a.m. in the parking lot of the Morrison Park Apartments. Winiger said the man was in possession of multiple weapons but did not elaborate on the types of weapons. Boise police received a call from the man, who was in his 50s, and police spoke to him from the parking lot while he was on an apartment balcony. Winiger said the man then came downstairs, charged at police with weapons, and died at the scene after two officers who were wearing body cameras shot him. The police department will place the two officers on paid administrative leave, as is standard policy. The Treasure Valley's Critical Incident Task Force has assigned the Meridian Police Department to investigate the shooting. The three most recent shootings by Boise police ended in the deaths of the unidentified man yesterday, 28-year-old Macy Juker, July 26th, and 22-year-old Peyton Wasson, June 24th. Boise police also shot and killed 32-year-old Eli Nash in a Meridian parking lot in January. The Idaho Statesman reports Boise police killed three people in 2016 and two each in 2004, 2017, and 2021. Boise police shot three people last year, but none of those people died of their wounds. The Washington Post and the Idaho Statesman have compiled data on the police killings, which show police in Idaho have shot and killed eight people so far this year. Besides the four Boise police have killed, Ada County deputies killed one person outside of Boise in April, and police in Blackfoot, Idaho Falls, and Pocatello each killed one person. This year is tied for the third most people killed by various Idaho police departments in a year since 2000. The Idaho Statesman reports police killed 13 people in the state in 2018 and 2021, and they killed eight people in 2019. An internal City of Lewiston report shows work done by an Idaho Falls firm the day before the High Reservoir in Lewiston Orchards collapsed in January caused a data acquisition system to become stuck, which caused the system to continually call for more water, which overfilled the reservoir and led to its collapse. The Lewiston Tribune obtained the report through a public records request. The report said an employee for Idaho Falls-based Contractor Control Systems Technology gained remote access to the city's supervisory control and data acquisition system for 5 minutes the day before the collapse. The worker was troubleshooting a problem with the $30 million upgrade to the city's water treatment plant, which feeds the reservoir. The employee with remote access instructed a control systems technology employee on site in Lewiston to disconnect control systems, to disconnect and reconnect the network cable. The loss of network connectivity caused values in the supervisory control to become stuck and the overfilling of the reservoir began. The report says the excessive pressure on the reservoir eventually led to its failure. The report says no alarms were triggered, quote, as the system didn't detect abnormal water levels or prolonged pumping due to the stuck value. Someone alerted police of a large amount of water on a road at about 3 a.m. the next day, January 18th. Police contacted water staff who found the supervisory control and data acquisition system unresponsive, so the water kept flowing into the high reservoir and the walls of the reservoir soon collapsed, causing millions of gallons to flow through the streets of Lewiston. The Lewiston Tribune reports individuals and businesses have filed 65 claims with the city for property damage, loss of belongings, and reduction of income due to the flooding. The city instituted a boil water order for about a week while workers disconnected the damaged reservoir from the rest of the city's water system. It cost the city about $3 million to fix the reservoir. City water customers were told not to use automated irrigation on lawns and gardens between early May and the end of July due to the reduction in the city water system's capacity. According to a news release from the U.S. Department of Labor, the agency has penalized 16 Rose Hour stores, including the one in Moscow, for not fairly compensating their employees. The news release said an investigation into the supermarket chain found violations of the Fair Labor Standards Act's overtime and record-keeping requirements in the 16 stores, including stores in Moscow, Lewiston, Colfax, and stores in Oregon and Montana as well. The release said the investigation led to the government recovering over $350,000 in back wages and damages for 602 Rosehour's employees. The release said the Department of Labor had imposed penalties on Rosehour's for the violations. According to Department of Labor spokesperson Michael Peterson, the back wages will be dispersed among the 602 employees. The release said during the investigation, the department found Rosehour's failed to pay employees for meal breaks less than 20 minutes in length as required under the Fair Labor Act, and also failed to include evening premium pay, hazard pay, and non-discretionary bonuses in regular pay rates when these stores calculated overtime pay for their employees. The Daily News reports the investigation also found the Rosehour's in Ridgefield, Washington, violated federal child labor regulations by allowing five minors under the age of 18 to operate the store's paper and cardboard baler. The Department of Labor's news release included Fair Labor Act violations at Rosehour's Pullman store, which has not yet opened at the former Dismore's IGA location. The release said any Rosehour's employees who feel they are owed back wages can call the Department of Labor at 866-487-9243 or go online to the Department of Labor's website and a page at dol.gov/agencies/WHD/WOW for more information. The phone number again for the Department of Labor, 866-487-9243. The conservative third-place finisher in the top two primary for Spokane mayor this week says he's unlikely to endorse either of two candidates moving on to the general election. Tim Archer says he has no plans to endorse either incumbent Mayor Nadine Woodward, who is known as a Republican in the nonpartisan race, or former Washington Commerce Secretary and State Senate leader Lisa Brown, who is a Democrat. In a second round of vote counting Wednesday, Lisa Brown had 46.9% of the vote and Nadine Woodward had 38%, which is a half percentage point decrease from election night tallies. Brown is leading by 3,600 votes over Woodward as of Wednesday evening, but in any case, both Brown and Woodward will advance to the November general election. Archer was a distant third place with about 5,000 votes, but his supporters might be crucial for Woodward. Archer said Woodward failed to earn support through the Republican Party. He said, "My voters' support must be earned, not assumed. She will have to make a better case this time." You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by the Moscow Food Co-op, specializing in food, goods, and programs that nourish and nurture our community. The Moscow Food Co-op is located at 121 East 5th Street. For more information, visit moscowfood.coop, call 882-8537, or find them on Facebook.
The National Agriculture Statistics Service reports honeybee colony losses in the Northwest are consistent with losses nationwide. The service reports the number of honeybee operations with five or more colonies dropped 7% in 2022 from the year before. In January through March of this year, the number of colonies was down 14% nationwide and down another 9% from April through June. The percentage for April through June is the same in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington, taking the three states' data together. In the three-month period, Oregon lost 17,500 colonies, or 18%, Washington lost 14,000 colonies, or 11%, and Idaho lost 7,000 colonies, or 5%. The National Agriculture Statistics Service reported the Varroa mite parasite, which feeds on bee larvae, were responsible for 41.6% of the lost colonies in Washington, 40.9% in Idaho, and 27.9% in Oregon. Bee-killing pesticides were responsible for 14.3% of the losses in Oregon, 9.2% in Washington, and 5.7% in Idaho.
An event is being held this weekend to honor a farm worker who died on the job in Bellingham. It also coincides with the anniversary of the dropping of an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Walking Together in Remembrance takes place on Sunday to recognize the passing in 2017 of Ernesto Silva Ibarra, a 28-year-old farm worker who collapsed from heat stress at work. Jason McGill is head of Northwest Youth Services, which fights youth homelessness in the community.
This walk is to remind all of us that we will not forget and we will continue to advocate for what is right for all.
The walking tour will begin at 10 a.m. at the Bellingham Theater Guild. The event is hosted by Community to Community Development, a grassroots organization that fights for immigrant and farm workers' rights. They will highlight the need for more farm worker protections as the climate crisis worsens. Sunday is the 78th anniversary of the United States dropping of an atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Before the bombing, Japanese Americans in Bellingham and along the West Coast were moved to concentration camps. McGill notes that Bellingham has a troubling past, including one of the oldest KKK chapters in Washington.
You only hear the positives about how progressive this community is, but this area has a really strong racist history.
The event will also mark the removal of indigenous people in the region from their traditional fishing sites. McGill is speaking at the event and will talk about his organization's opposition to a measure on the November ballot to build a new jail in the community. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Washington Department of Agriculture announced yesterday Washington farmers are now eligible for the $1 million compost reimbursement program. The Washington legislature established the compost reimbursement program during the last legislative session. The compost reimbursement program is intended to encourage farm compost use. The Daily News reports the program is open to all commercial farmers in agriculture, silviculture, and aquaculture. Farmers who apply to the program must agree to conduct soil sampling before the compost is applied and for several years afterward. The program requires the compost to be purchased from a business which holds a current solid waste handling permit. If approved for the program, participants must sign an agreement contract for pre- and post-soil sampling. After applying the compost, participants can submit a reimbursement application for their total expenses for obtaining the compost and for soil testing. The Agriculture Department will then calculate the expenses and reimburse 50% of the total expenses, not to exceed $10,000 per applicant. The Department of Agriculture said they expect to start accepting applications in September and will continue accepting them until the allotted money for the fiscal year, which runs from July through June, is exhausted. For more information on the compost reimbursement program, people can go to the Washington Department of Agriculture website, or they can email questions to compost@agr.wa.gov. That's compost@agr.wa.gov. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and by the Environmental Defense Institute, actively engaged with issues involving the Idaho National Laboratory, a Department of Energy nuclear site. EDI advocates for environmentally sound nuclear policy decisions.
We now turn to our featured segment. We have Joe Ivester speaking to the Moscow League of Women Voters on the politics of raising a transgender child. This was recorded September 19th, 2022 at the 1912 Center.
Thank you for coming today. I know this is an unusual day. We usually meet on Wednesdays, but we're just so fortunate and so grateful that Joe is in town this week, and this was the day that she was available, so we made ourselves available. So it gives me great, great pleasure to introduce Joe Ivester. Joe is coming to us from Austin, Texas, and She's a published author. She's written two books, the last one of which is Once a Girl, Always a Boy. And let me just read you some description. The title of her talk today is The Politics of Raising a Transgender Child. And it is a look at what it's like to have a transgender son in a world not quite ready for people like him. Jo describes her son's experiences going back to early childhood when he first showed signs of being transgender. By sharing these stories, Jo aims to help her audience become more comfortable with transgender individuals and challenges them to recognize the discrimination this community faces. So just a little bit more about Jo. In addition to her talks with students, church and temple groups, service organizations, and book clubs, Jo testifies before legislative and administrative bodies on proposed legislature and policies that impact the transgender community. She's a former college professor, so she's well experienced in talking before groups and, of course, with her book and her advocacy for transgender people. She's really had a lot of experience in talking with folks. So welcome. We're so glad to have you.
Thank you very much. A sound check. Can everybody hear me? Is this good? Okay, I'm getting the thumbs up from my husband back there in the yellow shirt and glasses, and so that's a good way for me to introduce him. He's very much a part of the advocacy story that you're going to be hearing today. We've really been partners in these efforts, though I'm the one that likes getting up on the stage and talking, and he engages more one-on-one, though I've seen him testify at the Capitol, and he's amazing. So my name is Jo Leibister. My pronouns are she and her. 32 years ago, we welcomed our son Jeremy into the world as what we thought was our daughter, and we were wrong. All through childhood, though, we didn't figure it out because we didn't have the understanding, the terminology, the context to realize who Jeremy was. He thought of himself as a tomboy, that's what we called him, that's what he called himself. We didn't realize that when he said tomboy, he was picturing something very different from when we said tomboy. He thought it was a special kind of boy. We thought it was what I had been, and so many of my friends growing up in the 1960s, that we were little girls who wanted to be able to do all the things that little boys got to do. And so it was, in some ways, a political statement to say, I'm a tomboy. And it's just delightful to see how our society has changed, and girls today can enjoy their femininity and still have so many of the opportunities that their brothers and their male cousins have. But that's not where we were when Jeremy was a kid. We said tomboy, he said tomboy. That wasn't right. But it wasn't until he was in his 20s that he started to really figure things out. At 23, he had top surgery to give himself a more masculine profile. At 24, he asked everybody to start using his new name and pronouns, and he went on hormones to change his voice and his general appearance and to grow a beard. And then a year later, he changed his name legally. So his journey, although it goes back to childhood, we didn't really know what was going on until much later. So today I'm basically going to share some of the stories going back to four-year-old Jeremy so that you can just have greater understanding. And the reason that we do that is because right now, in our culture in the U.S., transgender people are not very well understood or recognized. And the whole concept is unusual to many people, to most people. And when you don't understand something, it's easy to be frightened by it or even to hate it. And when you do understand, it becomes much easier to accept. So we're trying to build acceptance through gathering with folks exactly like you, and we love the League of Women Voters. My gosh, talk about an accepting group that's making a difference. So thank you for the work that you're all doing. We meet, as you heard, with church groups, temple groups, and one by one, we're hoping that folks can, by learning our story and seeing that, you know, we're just a normal family, that it's going to help. And we see it helping. So we're very lucky with what we get to do. Before I get into sharing the actual stories, I want to give a little bit of background information. Basically looking just at terminology. What does the term transgender mean? And I know that most of you probably are already familiar with it, you've heard it, and you have your own definition. But terminology keeps changing, and we keep trying to keep up. And so I wanted to share with you what it means specifically for Jeremy. So in Jeremy's case, when he was a baby, when he was born, the doctor looked at his anatomy and said, "This is a little girl." That didn't match, as Jeremy got older and started to have a sense of identity, it didn't match the gender that he knew himself to be, which was a little boy. When someone's identity that they know themselves to be doesn't match the way they were identified at birth, that's when you call them transgender. And Jeremy's just one example. We could have kind of the opposite, where the doctors say, look at the anatomy and say, "Well, this is a little boy." But in fact, inside, that kid starts to recognize, "No, I'm a girl." So that would be a transgender girl. And it may not be as binary as that. You may have heard the phrase non-binary. You may have a kid that gets identified by the doctors as a little girl who says, "Well, yeah, I'm kind of a little girl, but I'm also kind of a little boy, and I'm a little bit of both." And that would be a transgender person. Or someone who says, "No, I'm not a boy or a girl. I'm neither one." Or anywhere on this wonderful spectrum in between. So cisgender is kind of the opposite. I'm cisgender. What that means is when the doctors looked at me, they said, "This is a little girl." And from my earliest memories, I knew I was a girl. And I ask you to think about your earliest memories. From when people would first say, "Are you a boy or a girl?" You probably had something come to mind, even if you were only 2 or 3 years old. For me, the answer was, "I'm a girl." And that makes me cisgender. So that's the definition and the why I do this, why I get out and talk. I want to cover one more thing that you'll pick up in the way I talk. And that is that I always refer to Jeremy as Jeremy, and I will use male pronouns. Because that's who he is, and that's how I think of him when he was a child, even if my image of him is wearing a dress. When I think about that now, I think about a little boy wearing a dress. In my book, which hopefully some of you have seen now, maybe some of you have read, "Once a Girl, Always a Boy," I actually refer to Jeremy by his birth name, which was Emily, and I refer to him as she. Until that point in time, when he announced to the world, "I'm Jeremy, I'm he." And that was a tough decision as a writer and as an advocate, because that's considered actually rude. So when I referred to Jeremy by his birth name or by she, fellow advocates and trans individuals would say, "Oh, that's wrong. Haven't you learned?" And I first wrote the book referring to Jeremy and by he. My editor looked at it and said, "Joe, by doing that, you are denying your readers the opportunity to come on the journey with you." And that's when I came up with this compromise of referring to him as she in the first part of the book and as he in the second part. And I wrote a foreword that basically explains that. And I went to Jeremy and I said, "Would this be okay?" And he said, "Yeah." He understood what my editor was saying. And he said, "That's okay." And then I went to fellow advocates and I said, "Is this okay?" And they said, Yeah, no, I'm not really sure. This is a really tough question. What has Jeremy said? And then I went to some advocates who happened to be trans themselves. And they were actually more accepting than the cisgender advocates. And they said, if this is okay with Jeremy, it's okay with me. So after asking over a dozen people and several organizations what they thought, I came up with the compromise that's in the book. However, when I'm talking, and we only have this 1 hour together, I will always refer to him as Jeremy, even when I'm telling a story. Even if I'm reading an excerpt from the book, I've actually changed it. And it's partly because it just is so uncomfortable for me, after training myself for the last 8 years to say Jeremy and he, saying his birth name and she don't roll off my tongue. And I know that it's hurtful to a trans person to hear their birth name or to hear the wrong gender. And so, for those reasons, just go with the flow with me and recognize that I'm going to describe Jeremy as he, even when he was a little kid, so even before we knew. So I think that covers kind of the introduction, the why, the what, the how. If I were a journalist, I think I'd have to be throwing in the where, Texas, so very little Texas. That has certainly had an influence on our political involvement. And the when, also very influential, because until a few years ago, this wasn't getting a lot of attention. And because you are a politically aware group, I'm going to throw in some more political comments than I usually do. And I will share with you my personal theory as to why the last few years have been so tough. And I believe it's a backlash that after gay marriage became the law of the land, that folks that were bothered by that were looking for an issue that they could draw together other people that were upset about that and get elected into office, and they actually focus grouped it and said, what's going to carry, what's going to get the voters out? And it was, oh, let's beat up on trans people. And I'm being really blunt, and that's just my opinion, but I think that's the win. I think that's why this time in our history we're seeing such a problem, because trans people have been around as long as we've had people. And schools have figured out how to support the kids. And it's worked. But lately, it's just been hard. It's been really hard in states like Texas. So let me go back now, though, to when Jeremy was 4 years old. And Jeremy was a really, really happy little kid. He was one of those bouncy kids that he'd never stand still. You think, I walk around up here a lot, Jeremy would have paced a trail back and forth across the stage. I'd see him go to the neighbors across the street, and he would be knocking on the front door to see if his friend could come out and play. And I'd watch out the window, because he was only 4 years old, so I didn't want him out there by himself. And he'd be at the door knocking. And he wouldn't stay still. He was so exuberant and so enthusiastic and happy. And he had, just in our neighborhood, a group of little boys that happened to all be the same age, and they welcomed him into their group. They didn't care what was under his clothes. What they cared about was that he was happy. That made him be a lot of fun, and he was really good at sports, and he had a big brother that would teach them all how to play football, and they'd run around in our front yard playing football and baseball and basketball and any sport that included a ball. And Jeremy was a part of that. He was happy, and we could see his joy. And we were pushing him to be more feminine. As children of the 60s ourselves, we were very aware of wanting our kids to not grow up with sexual stereotypes. So we had four kids. We had our oldest daughter, and then our oldest son, and then Jeremy, who we thought was our daughter, but turns out to be our son, and then another son. And in each case, we wanted them to be able to dress the way they wanted to dress, to pursue the kinds of subjects that they wanted to pursue. My first major in college was physics, and I can remember being at a party and having someone say to me upon hearing what my major was, say, wait a minute, I thought you were a girl. Well, that was the end of that flirtation. But we didn't want that for our kids. So when Jeremy was being what we thought was a tomboy, we were fine with that. He had hand-me-down clothes from his big brother and his big sister. He always picked the hand-me-down boy clothes. So the one thing that was a little bit different, though, was that his hair was longer than what the boys would wear. He had his hair down around his shoulders. And at one point, a place opened up that catered to short haircuts for little boys, and Jeremy wanted to go there, not to get his hair cut real short, but just because he liked the environment and that they were targeting little boys, and all his friends were going there. So I called ahead of time to schedule an appointment, and I said, you know, by the way, my kid's hair is long, and this isn't the haircut that I see in all of your commercials. They were doing this big campaign on TV because they had just opened up. They said, don't worry, no problem, bring your kid in, we'll get a haircut. Well, it was a little bit of false advertising. We get there, and Jeremy is sitting down in the chair, and the woman cutting his hair, who was just very delightful, didn't really know how to cut longer hair. And Jeremy, at 4 years old, had enough of an artistic sense that he knew he was getting a bad haircut. And he's pulling on his hair on one side, trying to make it longer, because one side was so much longer than the other, and it just looked unbalanced. And I could see him trying not to look sad, because he was a middle kid and wanted to please everybody, but I could tell he was bothered. And so I decided to say something, and with that I'm going to switch over to reading a brief excerpt from my book.
And you're listening to Joe Ivester speaking to the Moscow League of Women Voters on the politics of raising a transgender child, recorded September 19th, 2022. We'll continue with Joe Ivester in just a moment.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by Hotchins Drug and Hobby of 307 South Main Street in Moscow. Hotchins features a pharmacy, educational toys, and hobbies. Hotchins also sells and services hearing aids. You can call Hotchins at 208-882-5536.
Valletta Recovery Center is a community of peer support for people dealing with addiction and mental health issues. Located at 531 South Main Street in downtown Moscow, Valletta Recovery Center offers a resource room, rotating calendar of life skills classes, mentoring for those beginning recovery, and telephone recovery services for those who can't make it into the center. All services are free. Find the Valletta Recovery Center on Facebook for more information.
You're tuned into KRFP Moscow Pullman. We now return to our featured segment, Joe Ivester speaking to the Moscow League of Women Voters on the politics of raising a transgender child.
And so this is in the early pages of the book. If anyone has the book with them and wants to follow along, I'm going to say don't, because I've changed it enough by cutting things that it'll be hard to follow. So just listen and picture Jeremy and me in the hair cutting salon, and little Jeremy's trying to look happy. Don't worry, sweetie. I'll fix it when we get home. Jeremy trusted me. He stopped squirming in his seat, smiled at the hairdresser, and settled in to wait. The moment he was done, he jumped up and ran to the car, saying, Mommy, it's okay, you'll make it better. I didn't know until an hour later just how prophetic his words had been. The moment we got home, we headed straight for the bathroom. I dragged my desk chair in from my study and placed it facing the mirror. Jeremy climbed up, eager to see how I was going to change his bedraggled appearance. Have you ever done this before? Sure, I answered, with more confidence than I felt. Oh, I used to trim Ben's hair all the time, Dennis, big brother. What are you going to do? How do you know where to cut? Will it look like Ben when you're done? His questions tumbled out so fast that I couldn't answer them, so I just went to work. I had to trim the hair really short before I could get it to look right. I don't know whether it was my inexperience with the scissors or the growing grin on Jeremy's face, but for some reason, I kept on cutting. And the more I cut, were more Jeremy Beamed. By the time I was done, he looked exactly like Big Brother Ben had 3 years earlier. He had a traditional boy's haircut, parted at the side, clipped neatly around the ears. I didn't have the words to explain why Jeremy was so ecstatic, but for the first time since becoming aware of how he looked, I could tell that he liked what he saw. Despite not understanding completely, I shared his joy. It didn't matter to me that his pleasure in looking like a boy was unusual. All I cared about as a mother was that somehow, in some way, I'd made my child happy. And he was happy. His elementary school years were great. That next day, after the haircut, he went to preschool. And all his little kid friends were confused. Because in Texas at that time, little boys had short hair and little girls had long hair. And here this kid shows up that they used to thinking of as a girl, and he looks like a boy. And so they were just asking him bluntly, the way little kids will do, are you a boy or a girl? And he told me about this when he got home. And I said, well, what did you say? And he told me he didn't answer them. He loved the fact that his friends thought, maybe I'm a boy. Now, if we had known then what we know today, the red flag would have gone up that said, hey, your kid may be trans. Do something. We might have been able to go to his school nurse or his pediatrician and say, what's going on? But we didn't have those resources. We had total unawareness ourselves. And so we just kind of muddled through. And that worked through elementary school. Tomboy Jeremy, just fine. One of the things he loved was sleepovers with his friends. And that was the first problem. So when he was about 8, maybe 9 years old, one of the moms called about a sleepover that was scheduled for that night and basically said, Jeremy can't stay over. Except she didn't say Jeremy, she used Jeremy's name. And at first I thought she was saying that she was canceling the whole evening, that there were problems. I'm saying, oh, you know, hey, no problem, the kids can come stay at our place. And she said, no, you don't get it. Emily is too old to sleep with the boys. And like that, Jeremy was excluded. And once one mom said he couldn't stay over, all the moms said he couldn't stay over. And in the same time frame, the little boys no longer wanted to play with him. Partly because he wasn't a part of the game as defined by the sleepovers, and partly because they were starting to hit puberty about a year or so after this had happened. And they were interested in what they defined as girly girls. They didn't want to play with a tomboy. They wanted to be flirting with a girl who would flirt back. And so Jeremy was kind of left on his own. He didn't fit in with the girls. They were all clustered together. The girls would hang out together and the boys would hang out together by the time he got to middle school. And he didn't fit in with the girls, but he didn't fit in with the boys either. And so he felt very alone. I'm going to share another couple of paragraphs with you that go back to those middle school days. And I should mention he was playing football. He was viewed as the only girl to ever have played football, both 7th and 8th grade, at that particular middle school. He was kind of a hero for doing that. The girls thought this is awesome. If they would interact with him, they said, this is great that you're standing up for women's rights. And he said, I'm not doing this to be political. I just like to play football. That's who he was. And he wrote, he said, we wrote the book together, so this is now in his voice as a middle schooler. When we're on the field and suited up, my teammates forget that I'm a girl. With my shoulder pads and helmet, I don't look any different from them, and we're all caught up in the game. But I feel left out, because we're no longer friends off the field. I thought 6th grade was tough, but 7th grade is even worse when it comes to not fitting in. One day, as we were hanging out before practice, waiting for the coaches to show up, I walked up to a group of guys who were laughing together. When I got there, though, they all went quiet. Whatever they were talking about, they didn't want to discuss it in front of me. Maybe it was girls or their bodies, but it made me really uncomfortable. So I climbed into the stands to sit alone, thinking, it's okay that they don't want me around. I can deal. But I couldn't. I couldn't make the feeling go away. My throat hurt and my chest tightened, and I felt isolated and deserted as I thought about how long it had been since I'd hung out with my teammates, like when we were little kids. I no longer had a social life. Well, middle school is hard for everybody. Puberty is hard for everybody, but it's even harder when you're transgender. And it's even harder when you're transgender and experience something called gender dysphoria, which means that the way your body is doesn't feel right. And so as Jeremy hit puberty and his breasts started to develop, he felt like his body was fighting him. It was doing something he didn't want. And he'd look around at his big sister or at the girls in his class, and they were so excited at the changes. And they wanted to dress in a way that made the changes obvious, and they were showing off and they were proud of their bodies. And Jeremy instead would walk around with his shoulders hunched over trying to hide his body. And he'd wear sweatshirts in Austin in the summertime when it was 100 degrees out because that hid his body more. So it was tough. Well, we didn't know because he threw himself into school activities. You already know he was an athlete. Well, he played every sport he possibly could. He not only played football, he was playing soccer and basketball, and he ran track, played second in district on hurdles. In fact, when they had the middle school graduation ceremony, one of the items in the program was to award a best boy athlete and a best girl athlete for the school. And the gym coach that had was up there announcing the best boys athlete, made his announcement, sat down, and the coach that had worked with the girls stood up. And she said, I'm actually not going to be the one to make the announcement of the best girl athlete. And she brought the football coach back up. And then he brought Jeremy up. And so Jeremy got that recognition, and on one hand, he was thrilled and happy because he worked so hard and he loved the sports, but he would have given anything to have been the one to receive the boys' recognition. Our whole school systems are set up to separate out gender, and that makes it so hard for the kids who are exploring their gender, or who have already explored and know that they don't fit with what everybody else is expecting. And that's a change that we need to bring into play somehow. There's no reason for kindergarten teachers to have the little boys line up separately from the little girls when they go to the cafeteria. But every time the teacher did that, Jeremy felt like he was in the wrong line. So he finishes middle school, he throws himself into sports, he joined the art club, he became president of the art club, he joined the school band. So John and I look at what we think is a well-adjusted kid, except that we knew he didn't have friends the way he did when he was in elementary school. He'd say, bring your friends over, come hang out the way they used to. And it turned out he just didn't have the friends. He was alone. College was great for him, though. He was over at Montana State, and he found a group of friends that didn't care, again, what was under his clothes, just like the kids in elementary school. So he could wear his hair short, he could wear men's clothing. People would think he was maybe a 14 or 15-year-old teenage boy instead of a 18 or 19-year-old young woman. But he was okay with that. He didn't like being thought of as young, but he sure loved being thought of as a boy. And it wasn't until he started talking that people would realize, wait a minute, this is what they perceive to be a woman. So he's wrestling with that, and then he's wrestling with his body. And he decided to take the major step of having top surgery. Top surgery is essentially like a mastectomy, a double mastectomy, with a little bit of added forming so that you end up with a masculine profile. And Jeremy did all his studying, he picked a doctor, he got it all lined up without telling us. And in the meantime, his big sister had said, I'm getting married, and you're going to be my maid of honor. Well, Jeremy hadn't worn a dress for years, and you probably noticed that being a maid of honor is a pretty feminine thing to do. And Jeremy had said yes, because this was his big sister, and he loved his big sister, and he didn't want to disappoint his sister. But right from the beginning, he knew that it wasn't going to work, that he couldn't wear the dress. And he agonized over it, and it really brought things to a head for him. And after a huge amount of soul-searching, he finally came to his sister, and without explaining that he had surgery scheduled, without explaining that he was suffering from gender dysphoria, he said, I can't wear the dress. But what I can do, if you will still have me by your side for the ceremony, I can wear the same slacks as the groomsmen, and a white shirt, and I'll have a vest made that matches all of the bridesmaids' dresses. And that's what he did. And he stood by his sister's side. And the extended family that was there, they just accepted him. They didn't say, oh, what's he doing not wearing a dress? It was just, oh, he looks so cute. He told me later that he would have rather they say he looked really handsome. But we were a bit cute at the time. Well, a lot happened in the next few months. We had a second wedding. His big brother got married, and his brother's fiance, now my daughter-in-law, had asked him to be one of the bridesmaids. And again, he had said yes. And again, he was having trouble dealing it. But now he didn't have to say anything, because the sister and the future sister-in-law got together and said, you know what, we're going to have the same thing going on. What are you going to do? And so my daughter-in-law and my oldest son got together, made a decision. They called Jeremy and said, you know what, how about if you just wear the same outfit that all the men are wearing? We'll rent one for you too. Jeremy was ecstatic. And then came the second part of the proposal. Don't stand with the bridesmaids. Stand with the groomsmen. Stand by my side with all the men. Now, we didn't have the understanding yet. We didn't have the language. But the love was there. And the acceptance. And that was incredible.
And you're listening to a talk from Joe Ivester speaking to the Moscow League of Women Voters on the politics of raising a transgender child. We'll continue with that in just a moment.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tie-dye-everything.com.
And you're listening to a presentation from Joe Ivester speaking to the Moscow League of Women Voters on the politics of raising a transgender child. And you're tuned to the KRFP Evening Report for Friday, August 4th. We'll now conclude with Joe Ivester's talk.
Well, by the time the wedding actually happened, Jeremy had shared with the family that he was going to have surgery. And I flew to Florida, met up with him there. There weren't a whole lot of surgeons in the country that did the surgery at that point. He found one in Florida that was great. They did this day in and day out. And Jeremy had studied the pictures, the before and after pictures. We stayed in a motel right near the hospital. He had the procedure done. And he was so incredibly happy with the way he looked for about 3 months. And after 3 months, he said, well, this is great. And I love having a flat chest and a male profile. But it's not enough. I want to have a deep voice. I want to have facial hair. Now, he still couldn't say I'm transgender. He'd explored it a little bit. And in his own mind, being trans was just too big a change. And he was terrified of change. And he didn't want to disappoint anybody. So he said, I'm going to go on hormones and I'm going to change my name, but I'm not saying that I'm transgender. Well, over the course of the next few months, he explored more and more what it means to be transgender, and he accepted himself. We had more conversations with him, made it clear we were perfectly okay with him going on hormones. This was easier to me than him having the surgery. That this seemed so natural at this point. And we just didn't know when it was all going to happen. And I didn't know that I'd already picked his name. What had happened during that week that we spent in the motel room with surgery was he said to me, this is as far as I'm going to take this, but if I decide to declare myself transgender and a man and express myself as a man, I don't want a name that's a popular baby name today. I want a name that you and Dad would have picked when I was born. And so all that week we talked about names. And one of the names I had proposed was Jeremy. And in his usual very laid-back self, he said, yeah, that's a possibility. I didn't know. It stuck. He liked the name. And so one day I'm looking on Facebook and I see a posting from him. And it says, hey guys, you may have noticed that my name's changed and my profile's picture is different. From now on, please call me Jeremy. Use male pronouns, he, him, his. And in a couple weeks I'm going to go on hormones, which means I'm going to go through a male puberty like many of you did when you were 13, 14 years old, and my voice is going to deepen, and maybe I'll grow a beard. Bye. And with that, he announced it to the world. Well, then I followed up with my own announcement, and I posted basically the same information he did, but then added how proud of him I was, and that he was the bravest man I know, and have demonstrated so much courage to explore and discover and declare his authentic self, and that we had been with him every step of the way and would continue by his side wherever his journey took him. Well, that post went viral. And I started to get Facebook messages from friends of friends of friends, people I'd never met. And at first they were very positive, and they were a lot of them from young adults that were somewhere in the LGBTQ community saying, thanks for being such an accepting mom. And I'm thinking, okay, good, pat on the back. I'm being a good mom here. And then I got some sadder letters. And they were from transgender young men who had a different story to tell. When they had come out to their parents when they were 15, 16 years old, they'd been kicked out of their homes. They lived on the street. And my heart broke. To think of these 15 and 16-year-old kids that are already dealing with so much, with the pain of gender dysphoria, and they were trying so hard to figure themselves out, and then to have their parents throw them out on the street. Their church communities deny them. So we don't want you here anymore. And in Texas, that was a big deal, because in many of the small towns in Texas, the church community is the major community. And John and I talked about it, and we said, we have to do something. And so we asked if Jeremy would mind if we became very public advocates. And Jeremy understood, and he said, I could write a book about him. And he said we could speak about him and share his story. And not long after that, there was a big dinner, a big fundraiser for the Anti-Defamation League, which is a big anti-discrimination organization, national. Some of you, I'm seeing nods, you've heard of it. And John and I were given the opportunity to speak for 4 minutes each at this gathering of 600 or 700 people. And John picked that moment to say to this room full of our friends and colleagues and strangers, my son is transgender. and we can't discriminate against my son and others like him. And Jeremy was there, sitting at the table with the rest of the family, and he was stunned. He knew that his dad was going to say something, but he didn't know exactly what. And after John stopped speaking, the room just kind of erupted with applause. And Jeremy didn't wait for John to get back to our table. He stood up and he raced toward John as he was walking back. And the two of them stood there and embraced. And anyone who hadn't gotten choked up before, when they watched father and son embrace like that, then they got choked up. And that was one huge step into political advocacy. What we learned was that transgender people face a really hard time. Over 40% of transgender teens have tried to die by suicide. Not just thought about it, they've actually tried to die. We have friends who found out their kids were trans in the form of a suicide note. We have friends who have said to us, when they've heard me share that statistic with audiences, they've come to me afterwards and said, "I don't know if you knew, but I'm one of that 40%. This is very real. And in Texas, while individuals may be very accepting, and we've found a wonderful advocacy community, our politicians are using a fear of transgender people as a political weapon to gain political points, and it's working. They're staying in office or they're getting elected to office, and we're trying to stop it. In the last legislative session in Texas, we had over 70 bills that got proposed that were anti-LGBTQ. And we were able to stop most of them. When I say we, the advocacy community, we would gather at the Capitol and rally and have speeches, and then those of us who were comfortable doing so would go door to door and speak to our senators and our House members. And John and I have done it in D.C. as well. And said, "This is a family with a trans son. This is what we look like. We're normal. We work. We pay taxes." John was an executive with a high-tech company and would say, "You know what? When Texas gets a reputation for discriminating, you make it harder for me to attract the youngest, the brightest talent coming out of school, because the new college students don't want to live in a place with a reputation for discrimination." And so we continue that battle. And now it's come to our school boards. In our own town, just north of Boston, we just recently had three school board members elected, and they ran on a platform saying, "Don't indoctrinate our children." Well, indoctrination is a kind of a code word for saying, "Don't teach about racial relations. Don't teach about having LGBTQ students here at our school. Don't say the word gay." So Texas is trying to catch up with Florida. So when those candidates won in our own town, our response was to say, "What can we do? Grassroots community building and political organizing." And we said, let's create a PFLAG chapter. PFLAG is Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. And now they just use the acronym because the words are not broad enough, because now we have a whole alphabet soup of LGBTQIA++, 2S, and so many different definitions. And we want to embrace all of that. So we started with an organizing meeting that we thought was going to be half a dozen people. And we held it in a bookstore that was not a big bookstore. It wasn't set up for a lot of people to be there. And we had 30 people show up, standing room only. They were backed up into the aisleways where the books were. And everyone said, "Yes, we need this." And someone let the newspaper know about it. And they published an article, and they called me and said, "Do you have an email for your new group?" I said, "Well, we are so new, we don't have an email yet, but you know what? I'm a public figure, use mine." So my name and email address went into that article, and I started getting letter after letter, and we've now doubled in size in a month. And now, this coming Monday night, when we get back to Austin, I'll be standing up at the school board meeting saying, "It's time to change the official school board policy so that your non-discrimination statement says we are not going to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation, gender expression, or gender identity. And we've been meeting with school board members. We've been meeting with the staff at the school that are responsible for the students' well-being and counseling and the student handbook and anti-bullying. And we're going to make a difference. And within the League of Women Voters, I know that you know how important this grassroots organizing is. And I don't know whether it's 5 years from now or 10 years from now or 20 years from now, but we will get there. I am very optimistic, and it's because I look at the acceptance of the young people. The high schoolers, they just accept when their friends are trans. They have no trouble with changing pronouns, with changing the names that they call people. It's taken the older generations a little bit longer, but that younger generation is going to be stepping up, and those are our future school board members. And those are the people that we're going to be bringing along. They are our future advocates. So with that, my ask of you is to become advocates yourself. You already are in so many ways, and I'm hoping that you will embrace the battle that transgender people face for recognition. And when your state legislators propose bills, which they have done, that are anti-trans, that you speak up. And I know that in many cases you're already trying to vote them out of office. I hope that, hearing from me today about my son and the battles that we faced in Texas, I hope that just energizes you to keep fighting. And I can't express enough how much I appreciate what you do. Because you are the voices that are going to make the world better for my son.
And that was a talk by Joe Ivester speaking to the Moscow League of Women Voters at the 1912 Center on the politics of raising a transgender child. That was recorded September 19th, 2022. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms tomorrow, widespread haze, mostly cloudy, high 79. 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms Saturday night, widespread haze, mostly cloudy, low 54. And a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms on Sunday, widespread haze, mostly cloudy, high 77. New rainfall up to a quarter of an inch, except higher amounts possible in thunderstorms. Sunday night, 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly before midnight, mostly cloudy, low 53. And on Monday, 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly in the afternoon, partly sunny, high 79. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Also on the KRFP.org website, you can listen to archived editions of the KRFP Evening Report or any show during the last 2 weeks by clicking on the heart on the KRFP front page, which will lead you to the two-week archive. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach and Kurt Morrison assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant weekend. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
Programming on KRFP is supported in part by Idaho AFL-CIO, dedicated to representing the interests of working people at the state and local level.
KRFP is also sponsored by the Palouse Folklore Society, celebrating traditional music and dance on the Palouse since 1982. the Palouse Folklore Society sponsors concerts, jam sessions, and a monthly contra dance. Find out more at palousefolk.org or on Facebook.
KRFP is a non-commercial community radio station that airs underwriting messages as a cost-effective way to let listeners know your business supports community radio. To sign up for underwriting spots, go to the KRFP website or visit the station at 114 East 3rd Street and pick up an underwriter's form.